Amy, with the advantage of size and weight, managed to push him over, and they fell together and rolled about in the sedges and mud, clawing and thumping. The Indian caught Jamie's long hair and yanked, bringing tears to his eyes. He punched the man hard in the ribs to make him let go, and when he did, butted him in the face. Their foreheads met with a dull thunk, and blinding pain shot through his head. They fell apart, gasping, and Jamie rolled up onto his knees, head spinning and eyes watering, trying to see. There was a blur of grey and a shriek of terror. Rollo gave one deep-chested, snarling bark, then settled into a rumbling, continuous growl. Jamie shut one eye, a hand to his throbbing forehead, and made out his opponent lying flat in the mud, Rollo poised over him, black lips drawn back to show all his teeth. The splash of feet running through the shallows, and Ian was there, gasping for breath. "Are you all right, Uncle Jimmy?" He took his hand away and looked at his fingers. No blood, though he would have sworn his head was split open. "No," he said, "but better than him." "Oh, Jesus. Did you kill the other one?" "Probably not." "Oh, God." Lowering himself to his hands and knees, he crawled a short distance away and threw up. Behind him, he could hear Ian sharply demanding to know who the men were and whether there were others with them in Cherokee. "They're Tuscarora," he said. His head still throbbed, but he felt a little better. "Oh, aye." Ian was surprised, but at once shifted into the tongue of the Ganyangahaga. The young captive, already terrorized by Rollo, looked as though he might die of fright, seeing Ian's tattoos and hearing him speak Mohawk. Ganyangahaga was of the same family as Tuscarora, and plainly the young man could make out what Ian said, for he replied, stammering with fear. "They were alone. Was his brother dead?" Jamie rinsed his mouth with water, splashed it on his face. That was better, though a lump like a duck's egg was swelling over his left eye. "Brother?" "Yes," the young man said, "his brother. If they did not mean to kill him now, might he go and see? His brother was wounded." Ian glanced at Jamie for agreement, then called Rollo off with a word. The bedraggled captive struggled painfully to his feet, staggering, and set off back along the shore, followed by the dog and the two naked Scots. The other man was indeed wounded. Blood was seeping through a crude bandage round his leg. He had made the bandage of his shirt and was bare-chested, scrawny, and starved-looking. Jamie glanced from one to the other. Neither could be older than 20, he thought, and likely younger than that, with their faces pinched by hunger and ill usage, their clothes little more than rags. The horses had moved off a little, nervous of the fighting, but the clothes the Scots had left hanging from the bushes were still there. Ian pulled on his breeches and went to fetch food and drink from the saddlebags, while Jamie dressed more slowly, interrogating the young man as the latter anxiously examined his brother. "They were Tuscarora," the young man confirmed. His name was a long one, meaning, roughly, the gleam of light on water in a spring. This was his brother, the goose that encourages the leader when they fly, more simply known as Goose.
"What happened to him?"
Jamie pulled his shirt over his head and nodded, wincing at the movement, at the gash in Goose's leg, quite obviously made by something like an axe. Light on Water took a deep breath and closed his eyes for a moment. He had a substantial knot on his head as well.
"Jalagi," he said. "We were 20 in number. The rest are dead or taken."
"You will not give us to them, Lord, please."
"Jalagi? Which?"
Light shook his head. He couldn't say. His band had chosen to stay when his village moved north, but they hadn't prospered. There weren't enough men to defend a village and hunt, and without defenders, others stole their crops, took their women. Growing poorer, they too had taken to stealing and begging to survive through the winter. More had died of cold and sickness, and the remnants moved from place to place, now and then finding a place to settle for a few weeks, but then driven out by the much stronger Cherokee. A few days past, they had been set upon by a party of Cherokee warriors who had taken them by surprise, killed most of them, and taken some women. "They took my wife," Light said, his voice unsteady. "We came to take her back."
"They will kill us, of course," said Goose weakly, but with a fair amount of cheerfulness.
"But that doesn't signify." "Of course not," Jamie said, smiling despite himself. "Do you know where they took her?"
The brothers knew the direction taken by the raiders and had been following to track them to their village.
"That way," they said, pointing toward a notch. Ian glanced at Jamie and nodded.
"Bird," he said. "Or fox, I should say."
For Running Fox was war chief of the village. A good warrior, though somewhat lacking in imagination. A trait Bird possessed in quantity.
"Shall we help them, then?" Ian said in English.
His feathery brows arched in question, but Jamie could see that it was a question in form only.
"Oh, I expect we will."
He rubbed gingerly at his forehead. The skin over the lump was already stretched and tender.
"Let's eat first, though."
It was not a question of whether the thing might be done, only how. Jamie and Ian both dismissed out of hand any suggestion that the brothers might steal back Light's wife.
"They will kill you," Ian assured them.
"We don't mind," Light said stoutly.
"Of course you don't," said Jamie. "But what of your wife? She'd be left alone then, and in no better case."
Goose nodded judiciously.
"He's right, you know," he said to his glowering brother. "We could ask for her," Jamie suggested. "A wife for you, Ian. Bird thinks well of you. He'd likely give her to you."
He was only half joking. If no one had yet taken the young woman to wife, the person who had her as slave might be persuaded to give her to Ian, who was deeply respected. Ian gave a perfunctory smile but shook his head.
"Nay, we'd best ransom her, or..."
He looked consideringly at the two Indians, industriously eating their way through the remainder of the food in the saddlebags.
"Might we ask Bird to adopt them?"
That was a thought, to be sure, for once they had got the young woman back, by whatever means, she and the brothers would be in the same dire case, wandering and hungry. The brothers frowned, though, and shook their heads.
"Food is a good thing," Goose said, licking his fingers. "But we saw them kill our family, our friends. If we hadn't seen it ourselves, it would be possible, but..."
"Aye, I see," Jamie said,
and was struck for an instant by mild astonishment that he did see. Evidently, he had spent longer among the Indians than he supposed. The brothers exchanged glances, obviously communicating something. Decision made, Light made a gesture of respect to Jamie.
"We are your slaves," he pointed out, with some diffidence. "It is yours to decide what to do with us."
He paused delicately, waiting. Jamie rubbed a hand over his face, considering that perhaps he hadn't spent quite enough time with Indians after all. Ian didn't smile, but seemed to emit a low vibration of amusement. MacDonald had told him stories of campaigns during the French and Indian War. Soldiers who took Indian prisoners commonly either killed them for scalp money or sold them as slaves. Those campaigns lay a scant 10 years in the past. The peace since had been frequently uneasy, and God knew the various Indians made slaves of their prisoners, unless they chose, for whatever inscrutable Indian motive, to adopt or kill them instead. Jamie had captured the two Tuscarora, ergo, by custom, they were now his slaves. He understood quite well what Light was suggesting, that he adopt the brothers and doubtless the young woman too once he'd rescued her. And how in God's name had he suddenly become responsible for doing that? Well, there's no market for their scalps just now, Ian pointed out. Though I suppose you could sell the two of them to Bird, though they're no worth a great deal, scrawny and ill-fecked as they are.
The brothers stared at him, impassive, awaiting his decision. Light belched suddenly and looked surprised at the sound.
Ian did laugh at that, a low creaking noise.
"Oh, I couldn't do any such thing, and the three of you ken that perfectly well," Jamie said crossly. "I should have hit you harder and saved myself trouble," he said to Goose,
who grinned at him with gap-toothed good nature.
"Yes, Uncle," he said, bowing low in deep respect. Jamie made a displeased sound in response, but the two Indians took no notice.
It would have to be the medals, then. MacDonald had brought him a chest bulging with medals, gilt buttons, cheap brass compasses, steel knife blades, and other bits of attractive rubbish. Since the chiefs derived their power from their popularity, and their popularity increased in direct proportion to their ability to give gifts, the British Indian agents exerted influence by distributing largesse to those chiefs who indicated a willingness to ally themselves to the crown. He'd brought only two small bags of such bribery, the rest left at home for future use. What he had on hand would, he was sure, be sufficient to ransom Mrs. Light, but to expend it all in such fashion would leave him empty-handed with respect to the other village chiefs, and that wouldn't do. Well, and he supposed he must send Ian back then to fetch more, but not until he'd arranged the ransom. He wanted Ian's help in that matter.
"Fine, then," he said, standing up.
He fought off a wave of dizziness.
"But I am not adopting them."
The last thing he needed just this minute was three more mouths to feed.
Chapter 44 Scotchy. Arranging the ransom was, as he had supposed, a simple matter of bargaining. And in the end, Mrs. Light came fairly cheap, at the price of 6 medals, 4 knives, and a compass. Granted, he hadn't seen her until the conclusion of the dealing. If he had, he might have offered even less. She was a small, pock-marked lass of perhaps 14, with a slight wall eye. Still, he reflected, there was no accounting for taste, and both Light and Goose had been willing to die for her. Doubtless she had a kind heart, or some other excellent quality of character, such as a talent and affinity for bed. He was quite shocked to find himself thinking such a thing, and looked at her more closely. It was in no way obvious, and yet, now that he did look, she did radiate that strange appeal, that remarkable gift held by a few women that bypassed such superficial appreciations as looks, age, or wit, and caused a man simply to wish to seize her and... He choked the sprouting image off at the root. He'd known a few such women, most of them French, and had thought more than once that perhaps it was his own wife's French heritage that was responsible for her possession of that most desirable, but very dangerous, gift. He could see Bird eyeing the girl thoughtfully, quite obviously regretting that he had let her go for so little. Fortunately, a distraction occurred to drive the matter from his attention, the return of a hunting party, bringing with them guests. The guests were Cherokee of the Overhill Band, far from their home in the Tennessee Mountains, and with them was a man Jamie had often heard of but never met until this day, one Alexander Cameron, whom the Indians called Scotchy. A dark, weathered man of middle age, Cameron was distinguishable from the Indians only by his heavy beard and the long, inquisitive shape of his nose. He had lived with the Cherokee since the age of 15, had a Cherokee wife, and was much esteemed among them. He was also an Indian agent thick with John Stewart, and his presence here, 200 miles from home, caused Jamie's own long, inquisitive nose to twitch with interest. The interest was frankly mutual. Cameron examined him with deep-set eyes in which intelligence and wiliness showed in equal measure.
"'The red-headed bear killer! Och, och!' he exclaimed, shaking Jamie warmly by the hand, and then embracing him in the Indian fashion. "'I've heard such tales of you, Ken, and fair dying to meet you to see were they true.'
"'I doubt it,' Jamie said. "'The last one I heard myself. "'I'd done for three bears at once, "'killing the last of them high in a tree "'where he'd chased me after chewing off my foot.'
"'Despite himself, Cameron looked down at Jamie's feet, "'then looked up and hooted with laughter, "'all the lines of his face curving in such irresistible merriment "'that Jamie felt his own laughter bubble up. "'It was not, of course, proper to speak of business yet a while.' The hunting party had brought down one of the woods buffaloes, and a great feast was preparing. The liver, taken away to be singed and devoured at once, the strap of tender meat from the back, roasted with whole onions, and the heart, so Ian told him, to be shared among the four of them, Jamie, Cameron, Bird, and Running Fox, a mark of honour. After the liver had been eaten, they retired to Bird's house to drink beer for an hour or two, while the women made ready the rest of the food. And in the course of nature, he found himself outside, having a comfortable piss against a tree, when a quiet footfall came behind him, and Alexander Cameron stepped up alongside, undoing the fall of his breeches. It seemed natural, though plainly Cameron had intended it, to walk about together for a bit then, the cool air of the evening a respite from the smoke inside the house, and speak of things of common interest. John Stuart, for one, and the ways and means of the Southern Department. Indians, for another, comparing the personalities and means of dealing with the various village chiefs, speculating as to who would make a leader, and whether there might be a great congress called within the year.
"You'll be wondering, I expect,"
Cameron said quite casually,
"at my presence here."
Jamie made a slight motion of the shoulders, admitting interest, but indicating a polite lack of inquisition into Cameron's affairs. Cameron chuckled.
"I will. It's no secret, to be sure. It's James Henderson, is what it is. You'll ken the name, maybe?"
He did. Henderson had been Chief Justice of the Superior Court in North Carolina, until the regulation had caused him to leave, climbing out the window of his courthouse and fleeing for his life from a mob bent on violence. A wealthy man, and one with a due regard for the value of his skin, Henderson had retired from public life and set about increasing his fortune, to which end he proposed now to buy an enormous tract of land from the Cherokee, this located in Tennessee, and establish townships there. Jamie gave Cameron an eye, apprehending at once the complexity of the situation. For the one thing, the lands in question lay far, far inside the treaty line. For Henderson to instigate such dealings was an indication, had any been needed, of just how feeble the grasp of the Crown had grown of late. Plainly, Henderson thought nothing of flouting His Majesty's treaty, and expected no interference with his affairs as a result of doing so. That was one thing. For another, though, the Cherokee held land in common, as all Indians did. Leaders could and did sell land to whites without such legal niceties as clear title, but were still subject to the ex post facto approval or disapproval of their people. Such approval wouldn't affect the sale, which would be already accomplished, but could result in the fall of a leader, and in a good deal of trouble for the man who tried to take possession of land paid for in good faith, or what passed for good faith, in such dealings.
"John Stuart knows of this, of course," Jamie said,
and Cameron nodded with a small air of complacency.
"Not officially, mind," he said.
"Naturally not. The Superintendent of Indian Affairs could hardly countenance such an arrangement officially. At the same time, it would be smiled on unofficially, as such a purchase couldn't help but further the department's goal of bringing the Indians further under the sway of British influence." Jamie wondered idly whether Stuart profited in any personal way from the sale. Stuart had a good reputation and wasn't known to be corrupt,
but he might well have a silent interest in the matter. Then again, he might have no financial interest himself, and be turning an officially blind eye to the arrangement only in furtherance of the department's purpose. Cameron, though. He couldn't say, of course, but would be most surprised if Cameron had no finger in the pie. He didn't know where Cameron's natural interest lay, whether with the Indians among whom he lived, or with the British to whom he had been born. He doubted that anyone did, perhaps not even Cameron. Regardless of his abiding interests, though, Cameron's immediate goals were clear. He wished the sale to be met with approval, or at least indifference, by the surrounding Cherokee, thus keeping his own pet chiefs in good odour with their followers, and allowing Henderson to go forward with his plans with no undue harassment by Indians in the area.
"I shall not, of course, see anything for a day or two," Cameron told him, and he nodded.
There was a natural rhythm to such business. But, of course, Cameron had told him now, so that he might be of help when the subject arose in due course. Cameron took it for granted that he would help. There was no explicit promise of a bit of Henderson's pie for himself, but no need. It was a sort of opportunity that was a perquisite of being an Indian agent, the reason that such appointments were considered plums. Given what Jamie knew of the near future, he had neither expectation nor interest in Henderson's purchase. But the subject did give him a welcome opportunity for a useful quid pro quo. He coughed gently.
"You ken the wee Tuscarora lassie I bought from Bud?"
Cameron laughed.
"Aye, and he's most perplexed at what you mean to do with her. He says you will not take any of the lassies he sends to warm your bed. She's no so much to look at, but still..." "Not that," Jamie assured him. "She's married, for one thing. I brought two Tuscaroran lads with me. She belongs to one of them."
"Oh, aye." Cameron's nose twitched with interest, scenting a story. Jamie had been waiting for this opportunity since the sight of Cameron first gave him the notion, and he told it well, with a satisfactory outcome that Cameron agreed to take the three displaced young Tuscaroras with him and sponsor their adoption into the Overhill Band.
"It'll no be the first time," he told Jamie. "There are more and more of them, wee scraps of what were villages, even whole peoples wandering about the country, starved and wretched. Heard of the Dogash, have you?"
"No."
"Nor are you like to," Cameron said, shaking his head. "There's no about 10 or so of them left. They came to us last winter, offered themselves as slaves, only so that they might survive the cold. No." "Dinna fash yourself, man," he assured Jamie, catching sight of Jamie's expression. "Your wee lads and the lass won't be slaves, my word on it."
Jamie nodded his thanks, pleased with the business. They had wandered some distance outside the village, and stood talking near the edge of a gorge, where the wood opened suddenly over a vista of mountain ranges, rolling away and away like furrows ploughed in some endless field of the gods, their backs dark and brooding beneath the starlit sky. "How can there ever be enough people to settle such a wilderness?" he said, moved suddenly by the sight of it. And yet the smell of wood smoke and cooking meat hung heavy in the air. People did inhabit it, few and scattered as they were. Cameron shook his head in contemplation.
"They come," he said, "and they keep on coming. My ain folk came from Scotland. You have," he added, teeth a brief gleam in his beard. "And then I mean to go back, I'll warrant."
Jamie smiled at that, but made no answer, though a queer feeling rose in his wame at the thought. He didn't mean to go back. Had said goodbye to Scotland at the rail of the Artemis, knowing full well it was likely his last sight of the place. And yet, the notion that he would never set foot there again had never fully settled on him till this moment.
Calls of "Scotchy! Scotchy!"
summoned them, and he turned to follow Cameron back to the village, conscious all the time of the glorious, terrifying emptiness behind him, and the more terrifying emptiness within. They smoked that night, after feasting, in ceremonious observation of Jamie's bargain with Bird, in welcome to Cameron. When the pipe had gone twice round the fire, they began to tell stories. Stories of raids, of battles. Exhausted from the day, head still throbbing, mellowed by food and spruce beer, and slightly intoxicated by the smoke, Jamie had meant only to listen. Perhaps it was the thought of Scotland so casually evoked by Cameron's remark. But at some point, a memory had stirred, and when the next expectant silence fell, he was surprised to hear his own voice telling them of Culloden.
"And there, near a wall, I saw a man I knew named MacAllister, besieged by a horde of enemies. He fought with gun and sword, but both failed him. His blade was broken, his shield shattered upon his breast."
The fume of the pipe reached him, and he raised it, and drew deep, as though he drank the air of the moor, hazed with rain and the smoke of the day.
"Still they came, his enemies, to kill him, and he seized up a piece of metal, the tongue of a wagon, and with it killed 6.
He held up both hands, fingers stuck up in illustration. 6 of them, before he was at last brought down. Sounds of awe and tongue clicks of approval greeted this recounting.
"And you yourself, Bear Killer, how many men did you kill in this battle?"
The smoke burned in his chest, behind his eyes, and for an instant he tasted the bitter smoke of cannon fire, not sweet tobacco. He saw Alistair MacAllister, dead at his feet among the red-clothed bodies, the side of his head crushed in, and the round curve of his shoulder shining solid through the cloth of the shirt, so wetly did it cling to him. He was there, on the moor, the wet and cold no more than a shimmer on his skin, rain slick on his face, his own shirt sopping and steaming on him with the heat of his rage. And then he no longer stood on Dromossi, and became aware a second too late of the indrawn breaths around him. He saw Robert Tawtree's face, the wrinkles all turned up in astonishment, and only then looked down to see all 10 of his fingers flex and fold, and the 4 fingers of the right extend again, quite without his meaning it. The thumb wavered, indecisive. He watched this with fascination. Then, coming finally to his wits, balled his right hand as well as he could, and wrapped the left around it, as though to throttle the memory that had been thrust with such unnerving suddenness into the palm of his hand. He looked up to see Tawtree glance sharply at his face, and he saw the dark old eyes harden, then narrow under a frown. And then the old man took the pipe, drank deep, and blew the smoke across him, bowing forward. Tawtree did this twice more, and a hum of hushed approval at the honour came from the clustered men. He took the pipe and returned the honour of the gesture, then passed it to the next man, refusing to speak further. They didn't push him to, seeming to recognise and respect the shock he felt. Shock? Not even that. What he felt was the blankest astonishment. Cautiously, unwillingly, he stole a peek at that picture of Alistair. God, it was there. He realised that he was holding his breath, not wanting to breathe the reek of blood and spilled bowels. He breathed soft smoke and a copper tang of seasoned bodies, and could have wept, swept with sudden longing for the cold, sharp air of the Highlands, pungent with the scents of peat and gorse. Alexander Cameron said something to him, but he couldn't reply. Ian, seeing the difficulty, leaned forward to answer, and they all laughed. Ian gave him a curious look, but then turned back to the conversation, beginning a story of a famous game of lacrosse he had played among the Mohawk.
leaving Jamie to sit still, wreathed in the smoke. 14 men, and he didn't remember a single face. And that random thumb hovering uncertainly. Whatever did he mean by that? That he had fought yet another, but had not made certain of the fellow? He was afraid even to think of the memory, unsure what to do with it, but at the same time conscious of a sense of awe, and despite everything, grateful to have this small thing back. It was very late, and most of the men had gone to their own houses or lay comfortably asleep around the fire. Ian had left the fire but hadn't come back. Cameron was still there, smoking his own pipe now, though he shared this with Bird, taking turn and turn about.
"There is a thing I would tell you," Jamie said abruptly in the midst of a drowsy silence. "Both of you."
Bird raised his brows in slow question, drugged with tobacco. He hadn't known he meant to say it, had thought to wait, judge his time if he spoke at all. Perhaps it was the closeness of the house, the dark intimacy of the fireside, or the intoxication of tobacco. Perhaps only the kinship of an exile for those who would suffer the same fate. But he'd spoken, had no choice now but to tell them what he knew.
"The women of my family are..."
He groped, not knowing the Cherokee word.
"Those who see in dreams what is to come."
He darted a look at Cameron, who appeared to take this in his stride, for he nodded and closed his eyes to draw smoke into his lungs.
"Have they the sight, then?" he asked, mildly interested.
Jamie nodded. It was as good an explanation as any.
"They have seen a thing concerning the Jalagi. Both my wife and daughter have seen this thing."
Bird's attention sharpened hearing this. Dreams were important. For more than one person to share a dream was extraordinary, and therefore most important.
"It grieves me to tell you," Jamie said, and meant it. 60 years from this time, the Jalagi will be taken from their lands, removed to a new place. Many will die on this journey, so that the path they tread will be called..."
He groped for the word for tears, didn't find it, and ended,
"the trail where they wept."
Bird's lips pursed as though to draw smoke, but the pipe fumed unnoticed in his hand.
"Who will do this?" he asked. "Who can?"
Jamie drew a deep breath. Here was the difficulty. And yet, so much less difficult than he had thought, now that it came to the matter.
"It will be white men," he said, "but it will not be King George's men." "The French?"
Cameron spoke with a hint of incredulity, but frowned nonetheless, trying to see how this might come to pass.
"Or the Spanish, do they mean?" "The Spanish are a good deal closer, but none seem any."
Spain still held the country south of Georgia, and parts of the Indies, but the English held Georgia firmly. There was little apparent chance of any northward movement by the Spanish.
"No, not Spanish.
Not French." He could wish Ian had stayed, for more than one reason. But the lad had not, and so he would have to struggle with the Jalagi, which was an interesting tongue, but one in which he could talk fluently only of solid things, and of a very limited future.
"What they tell me, what my women say,"
he struggled to find sensible words,
"a thing that they see in their dreams, this thing will come to pass if it concerns many people. But they think it may not come to pass if it concerns a few or one."
Bird blinked, confused, and no wonder. Grimly, Jamie tried again to explain.
"There are large things, and there are small things. A large thing is a thing like a great battle, or the raising up of a notable chief. Though he is one man, he is raised up by the voices of many. If my women dream of these large things, then they will happen. But in any large thing, there are many people. Some say, do this, others, do that.
He zigzagged his hand to and fro, and Bird nodded.
So, if many people say, do this,
he snapped his fingers sharply to the left,
then this happens. But what of the people who said, do that?
And he jerked a thumb back the other way.
These people may choose a different way.
Bird made the
sound he used when startled. So it may be that some will not go,
Cameron asked sharply.
They might escape.
I hope so,
Jamie said simply. They sat in silence for a bit, each man staring into the fire, each seeing his own visions of the future or the past.
This wife you have,
Bird said at last, deeply contemplative.
Did you pay a great deal for her? She cost me almost everything I had,
he said, with a wry tone that made the others laugh.
But worth it.
It was very late when he went to the guest house. The moon had set, and the sky had that look of deep serenity, the stars singing to themselves in endless night. His body ached in every muscle, and he was so tired that he stumbled on the threshold. His instincts were still working, though, and he felt, rather than saw, someone move in the shadows of the sleeping couch.
God, Bird was still at it. Well, tonight it wouldn't matter. He could lie naked with a covey of young women and sleep sound.
Too exhausted to be annoyed by her presence, he struggled for some polite acknowledgement of the woman. Then she stood up. The firelight showed him an elderly woman, her hair in grizzled plaits, her dress of white buckskin decorated with paint and porcupine quills. He recognized Calls in the Forest, dressed in her best. Bird's sense of humor had finally got completely out of hand. He had sent Jamie his mother. All grasp of Jalagi deserted him. He opened his mouth but merely gaped at her. She smiled very slightly and held out her hand.
Come and lie down, bear killer, she said.
Her voice was kind and gruff.
I've come to comb the snakes from your hair.
She drew him unresisting to the couch and made him lie down with his head in her lap. Sure enough, she unplaited his hair and spread it out across her knees, her touch soothing to his throbbing head and the painful knot on his brow. He had no idea how old she might be, but her fingers were muscular and tireless, making small rhythmic circles in his scalp, on his temples, behind his ears, near to the bone at the base of his skull. She had thrown sweet grass and some other herb on the fire. The chimney hole was drawing well, and he could see white smoke rising upward in a wavering pillar, very calm, but a sense of constant movement in it. She was humming to herself, or rather whispering some song, the words too indistinct to make out. He watched the silent shapes stream upward in the smoke, and felt his body growing heavy, limbs filled with wet sand, his body a sandbag placed in the path of a flood.
Talk, bear killer, she said, very softly, breaking off her chant.
She had a wooden comb in her hand. He felt the teeth of it caress his scalp, rounded with wear.
I cannot call your words to me, he said, searching for each word in Jalagi, and thus speaking very slowly.
She made a small snorting noise in reply.
The words don't matter, nor the tongue in which you speak, she said. Only talk. I will understand.
And Zoe began haltingly to speak, in Gaelic, as it was the only tongue that didn't seem to require any effort. He understood that he was to speak of what filled his heart, and so began with Scotland and Culloden, of grief, of loss, of fear. And in the speaking turned from past to future, where he saw these three spectres loom again, cold creatures coming toward him out of the fog, looking through their empty eyes. Another stood among them, Jack Randall, confusingly on both sides of him. Those eyes were not empty, but alive, intent in a misty face. Had he killed the man or not? If he had, did the ghost follow at his heels? Or if he had not, was it the thought of vengeance unsatisfied that haunted him, taunted him with its imperfect memory? But in the speaking, he seemed somehow to rise a little way above his body and see himself at rest, eyes open, fixed upward, his hair darkly flaming in a halo round his head, streaked with the silver of his age. And here he saw that he merely was, in a place between, apart, and quite alone, at peace. "I hold to no evil in my heart," he said, hearing his voice come slow from a long way off. "This evil does not touch me. More may come, but not this, not here, not now." "I understand," whispered the old woman, and went on combing his hair as the white smoke rose silent toward the hole to the sky. Chapter 45. A Taint in the Blood. June 1774. I sat back on my heels and stretched, tired but pleased. My back ached, my knees creaked like hinges, my fingernails were caked with dirt, and strands of hair stuck to my neck and cheeks. But the new crops of pole beans, onions, turnips and radishes were planted, the cabbages weeded and culled, and a dozen large peanut bushes had been pulled up and hung to dry on the garden palisades, safe from marauding squirrels. I glanced up at the sun, still above the chestnut trees. Time enough, then, before supper, for a last chore or two. I stood up and surveyed my small kingdom, debating where best to spend my remaining time. Rooting up the catmint and lemon balm that threatened to engulf the far corner of the garden. Carting baskets of nicely rotted manure up from the heap behind the barn. No, that was man's work. Herbs? My three French lavender bushes stood knee-high, thick with deep blue swabs on slender stalks, and the yarrow was well in bloom, with lacy umbels of white and pink and yellow. I rubbed a finger under my itching nose, trying to recall whether this was the proper phase of the moon in which to cut yarrow. Lavender and rosemary should be cut in the morning, though, when the volatile oils had risen with the sun. It wasn't as potent if taken later in the day. Down with the mint, then. I reached for the hoe I had left leaning against the fence, saw a face leering through the palisades, and started back, my heart leaping into my throat. Oh! My visitor had jumped back, too, equally startled.
Bitter, ma'am. Didn't mean to fright you.
It was Manfred MacGillivray, peeping shyly through the drooping vines of morning glory and wild yam. He'd come earlier in the day, bringing a canvas-wrapped bundle containing several muskets for Jamie. That's all right. I stooped to pick up the hoe I had dropped. Are you looking for Lizzie? She's in...
Ach, no, ma'am. That is, I... Do you think I might have a word, ma'am? He asked abruptly. Alone, like.
Of course. Come along in. We can talk while I hoe. He nodded and went round to let himself in by the gate. What might he want with me, I wondered. He had on a coat and boots, both covered in dust, and his breeches were badly creased. He'd been riding some way then, not just from his family's cabin. And he hadn't been into the house yet. Mrs. Bug would have dusted him off forcibly. "Where have you come from?" I asked, offering him the gourd dipper from my water bucket. He accepted it, drinking thirstily, then wiped his mouth politely on his sleeve.
"Thank you, ma'am. I've been to Hillsborough for to fetch the things for Mr. Fraser."
"Really? That seems a long way," I said mildly. A look of profound uneasiness crossed his face. He was a nice-looking boy, tanned and handsome as a young fawn under his crop of dark, curly hair.
but he looked almost furtive now, glancing back over his shoulder toward the house as though fearful of interruption.
Well, ma'am, that's to do a bit with what I meant to speak to you about.
Oh? Well. I made a cordial gesture, indicating that he should feel free to unburden himself, and turned away to begin my hoeing so that he might feel less self-conscious. I was beginning to suspect what he wanted to ask me, though I wasn't sure what Hillsborough had to do with it.
It's to do with Miss Lizzie, he began, folding his hands behind him.
Yes, I said encouragingly, nearly sure that I was right in my suppositions. I glanced toward the western end of the garden, where the bees were buzzing happily among the tall yellow umbels of the docko plants. Well, it was better than the 18th-century notion of condoms, at least.
I can't marry her, he blurted.
What? I stopped hoeing and straightened up, staring at him. His lips were pressed tightly together, and I saw now that what I had taken for shyness had been his attempt to mask a deep unhappiness that now showed plainly in the lines of his face. You'd better come and sit down. I led him to the small bench Jamie had made me, set beneath the shade of a black gum tree that overhung the north side of the garden. He sat, head drooping, and hands trapped between his knees. I took off my broad-brimmed sun hat, wiped my face on my apron, and pinned up my hair more neatly, breathing in the cool freshness of the spruce and balsam trees that grew on the slope above. "What is it?" I asked gently, seeing that he didn't know how to start. "Are you afraid that perhaps you don't love her?" He gave me a startled look, then turned his head back to the studied contemplation of his knees. "Oh, no, ma'am. I mean, I don't. But that's no matter."
"It isn't?"
"No. I mean, I'm sure we should grow to be fond of one another. Meine Mutter says so. And I like her well enough now, to be sure." He added hastily, as though fearing this might sound insulting. Da says she's a tidy wee soul, and my sisters are very fond of her indeed. I made a non-committal sound. I had had my doubts about this match to begin with, and it was beginning to sound as though they were justified. Is there perhaps someone else? I asked delicately. Manfred shook his head slowly, and I heard him swallow hard.
No, ma'am, he said in a low voice.
You're sure?
Aye, ma'am.
He drew a deep breath.
I mean, there was. But that's all done with now.
I was puzzled by this. If he had decided to renounce this mysterious other girl, whether out of fear of his mother or for some other reason, then what was stopping him from going through with the marriage to Lizzie? The other girl... Is she by chance from Hillsborough? Things were coming a little clearer. When I had first met him and his family at the gathering, his sisters had exchanged knowing glances at mention of Manfred's visits to Hillsborough. They'd known about it then, even if Uta had not.
Aye, that's why I went to Hillsborough. I mean, I had to go for the, but I meant to see Myra. And tell her that I would be married to Miss Weems and couldn't come to see her any more.
Myra. So she had a name, at least. I sat back, tapping my foot meditatively. You meant to. So you didn't see her after all. He shook his head again, and I saw a tear drop and spread suddenly on the dusty homespun of his breeches.
No, ma'am, he said. His voice half-choked. I couldn't. She was dead.
Oh, dear, I said softly. Oh, I am so sorry. The tears were falling on his knees, making spots on the cloth, and his shoulders shook, but he didn't make a sound. I reached out and gathered him into my arms, holding him tight against my shoulder. His hair was soft and springy, and his skin flushed with heat against my neck. I felt helpless to deal with his grief. He was too old to comfort with mere touch, too young, perhaps, to find any solace in words. There was nothing I could do for the moment save hold him. His arms went round my waist, though, and he clung to me for several minutes after his weeping was spent. I held him quietly, patting his back, and keeping watch through the flickering green shadows of the vine-twined palisades, lest anyone else come looking for me in the garden. At last he sighed, let go, and sat up. I groped for a handkerchief, and, not finding one, pulled off my apron and handed it to him to wipe his face. "You needn't marry right away," I said, when he seemed to have regained possession of himself. "It's only right that you should take a little time to heal. But we can find some excuse to put the wedding off. I'll speak to Jamie." But he was shaking his head, a look of sad determination taking the place of tears.
"No, ma'am," he said, low-voiced but definite. "I can't."
"Why not?"
"Myra was a whore, ma'am. She died of the French disease."
He looked up at me then, and I saw the terror in his eyes behind the grief.
"And I think I've got it." "You're sure?"
Jamie set down the hoof he'd been trimming and looked bleakly at Manfred.
"I'm sure," I said tartly.
I had obliged Manfred to show me the evidence. In fact, I had taken scrapings from the lesion to examine microscopically, then took him straight to find Jamie, barely waiting for the boy to do up his breeches. Jamie looked fixedly at Manfred, plainly trying to decide what to say. Manfred, purple-faced from the double stress of confession and examination, dropped his own eyes before this basilisk gaze, staring at a crescent of black hoof-parings that lay on the ground.
"I'm not sorry, sir," he murmured. I didn't mean to." "I shouldn't suppose anyone does," Jamie said.
He breathed deeply and made a sort of subterranean growling noise that caused Manfred to hunch his shoulders and try to withdraw his head, turtle-like, into the safer confines of his clothing. "He did do the right thing," I pointed out, trying to put the best face possible on the situation. "Now, I mean, telling the truth." Jamie snorted.
"Well, he couldn't be poxing wee Lizzie now, could he? That's worse than only going wi' a whore."
"I suppose some men would just keep quiet about it and hope for the best."
"Aye, some would."
He narrowed his eyes at Manfred, evidently looking for overt indications that Manfred might be a villain of this description. Gideon, who disliked having his feet messed about and was consequently in bad temper, stamped heavily, narrowly missing Jamie's own foot. He tossed his head and emitted a rumbling noise that I thought was roughly the equivalent of Jamie's growl.
"Aye, well."
Jamie left off glaring at Manfred and grabbed Gideon's halter.
"Go along to the house with him, Sassnach. I'll finish here and then we'll have Joseph in and see what's to do."
"All right." I hesitated, unsure whether to speak in front of Manfred. I didn't want to raise his hopes too much until I'd had a chance to look at the scrapings under the microscope. The spirochetes of syphilis were very distinctive, but I didn't think I had a stain that would allow me to see them with a simple light microscope, such as mine was. And while I thought my homemade penicillin could likely eliminate the infection, I would have no way of knowing that for certain unless I could see them, and then see that they had disappeared from his blood. I contented myself with saying, "I have got penicillin, mind."
"I ken that well enough, Sassenach."
Jamie switched his baleful look from Manfred to me. I'd saved his life with the penicillin twice, but he hadn't enjoyed the process. With a Scottish noise of dismissal, he bent and picked up Gideon's enormous hoof again. Manfred seemed a bit shell-shocked and said nothing on the way to the house. He hesitated at the door to the surgery, glancing uneasily from the gleaming microscope to the open box of surgical tools, and then toward the covered bowls lined up on the counter in which I grew my penicillin colonies. "Come in," I said, but was obliged to reach out and take him by the sleeve before he would step across the threshold. It occurred to me that he hadn't been to the surgery before. It was a good 5 miles to the MacGillivray's place, and Frau MacGillivray was entirely capable of dealing with her family's minor ills. I wasn't feeling terribly charitable toward Manfred at the moment, but gave him a stool and asked if he would like a cup of coffee. I thought he could probably use a stiff drink if he was about to have an interview with Jamie and Joseph Weems, but supposed I'd better keep him clear-headed.
"No, ma'am," he said, and swallowed, white-faced. "I mean, thank you. No."
He looked extremely young and very frightened.
"Roll up your sleeve, then, please. I'm going to draw a bit of blood, but it won't hurt much. How did you come to meet the, young lady? Myra, that was her name?"
"Aye, ma'am."
Tears welled in his eyes at her name. I suppose he really had loved her, poor boy. Or thought he had. He had met Myra in a tavern in Hillsborough. She had seemed kind, he said, and was very pretty. And when she asked the young gunsmith to buy her a glass of Geneva, he had obliged, feeling dashing.
So we drank a bit together, and she laughed at me, and...
He seemed rather at a loss to explain how matters had progressed from there, but he had waked up in her bed. That had sealed the matter, so far as he was concerned, and he had seized every excuse to go to Hillsborough thereafter. "How long did this affair go on?" I asked, interested. Lacking a decent syringe for drawing blood, I'd merely pierced the vein inside his elbow with a fleam and drained off the welling blood into a small vial. For the better part of 2 years, apparently.
"I kent I couldna wed her," he explained earnestly. "Meine Mutter would never..."
He trailed off, assuming the look of a startled rabbit hearing hounds in its immediate vicinity.
"Grüß Gott," he said.
"My mother!" I'd been wondering about that particular aspect of the affair myself. Uta MacGillivray wasn't going to be at all pleased to hear that her pride and joy, her only son, had contracted a disreputable disease, and furthermore, one which was about to lead to the breaking of his carefully engineered engagement, and very likely to a scandal that the entire back country would hear about. The fact that it was generally a fatal disease would probably be a secondary concern.
"She'll kill me," he said,
sliding off his stool and rolling his sleeve down hastily. "Probably not," I said mildly, "though I suppose..." At this fraught moment came the sound of the back door opening and voices in the kitchen. Manfred stiffened, dark curls quivering with alarm. Then heavy footsteps started down the hall toward the surgery, and he dived across the room, flung a leg across the windowsill, and was off, running like a deer for the trees.
"Come back here, you ass!" I bellowed through the open window. "Which ass is that, auntie?"
I turned to see that the heavy footsteps belonged to young Ian. Heavy, because he was carrying Lizzie Weems in his arms.
"Lizzie, what's the matter?
Here, put her on the table." I could see at once what the matter was. A return of the malarial fever. She was limp, but shivered nonetheless with chill, the contracting muscles shaking her like jelly.
"I've found her in the dairy shed," Ian said, laying her gently on the table. "The deaf Beardsley came rushing out as though the devil was chasing him, saw me, and dragged me in. She was on the floor with the churn overturned beside her."
This was very worrying. She hadn't had an attack for some time, but... For a second time, the attack had come upon her too suddenly for her to go for help, causing almost immediate collapse. "Top shelf of the cupboard," I said to Ian, hastily rolling Lizzie on her side and undoing her laces. "That bluish jar, no, the big one." He grabbed it without question, removing the lid as he brought it to me.
"Jesus, Auntie, what's that?"
He wrinkled his nose at the smell from the ointment.
"Gallberries and cinchona bark in goose grease, among other things. Take some and start rubbing it into her feet."
Looking bemused, he gingerly scooped up a dollop of the purplish-grey cream and did as I said, Lizzie's small bare foot nearly disappearing between the large palms of his hands.
"Will she be all right, do you think, Auntie?"
He glanced at her face, looking troubled. The look of her was enough to trouble anyone, the clammy colour of whey, and the flesh gone slack, so that her delicate cheeks juddered with the chills.
"Probably. Close your eyes, Ian."
I'd got her clothes loosened and now pulled off her gown, petticoats, pocket and stays. I threw a ratty blanket over her before working the shift off over her head. She owned only two, and wouldn't want one spoiled with the reek of the ointment. Ian had obediently closed his eyes, but was still rubbing the ointment methodically into her feet, a small frown drawing his brows together, the look of concern lending him for a moment a brief but startling resemblance to Jamie. I drew the jar toward me, scooped up some ointment, and reaching under the blanket began to rub it into the thinner skin beneath her armpits, then over her back and belly. I could feel the outlines of her liver distinctly, a large, firm mass beneath her ribs. Swollen and tender from the way she grimaced at my touch, there was some ongoing damage there, certainly.
"Can I open my eyes now?"
"Oh, yes, of course. Rub more upper legs, please, Ian." Shoving the jar back in his direction, I caught a glimpse of movement in the doorway. One of the Beardsley twins stood there, clinging to the jam, dark eyes fixed on Lizzie. Kezzy, it must be. Ian had said the deaf Beardsley had come to fetch help. "She'll be all right," I said to him, raising my voice. And he nodded once, then disappeared with a single burning glance at Ian.
"Who was it you were shouting at, Auntie Claire?"
Ian looked up at me, clearly as much to preserve Lizzie's modesty as from courtesy to me. The blanket was turned back, and his big hands were smoothing ointment into the skin above her knee, thumbs gently circling the small, rounded curves of her patella, her skin so thin that the pearly bone seemed almost visible through it.
"Who?" "Oh, Manfred MacGillivray," I said, suddenly recollecting. "Damn, the blood!"
I leapt up and wiped my hands hurriedly on my apron. Thank God I'd corked the vial. The blood inside was still liquid. It wouldn't keep long, though.
"Do her hands and arms, would you please, Ian? I've got to manage this quickly."
He moved obligingly to do as I said, while I hastily spilled a drop of blood on each of several slides, dragging a clean slide across each one to make a smear.
What sort of stain might work on spirochetes?
No telling. I try them all. I explained the matter disjointedly to Ian as I pulled stain bottles out of the cupboard, made up the solutions, and set the slides to soak.
The pox?
Poor lad, he must be nearly mad with fright.
He eased Lizzie's arm, gleaming with ointment, under the blanket, and tucked it gently round her. I was momentarily surprised at this show of sympathy, but then remembered. Ian had been exposed to syphilis some years before, after his abduction by Gilles Duncan. I hadn't been sure that he had the disease, but had dosed him with the last of my 20th-century penicillin, just in case.
"Did you not tell him you could cure him, though, Auntie?"
"I hadn't the chance. Though I'm not absolutely sure that I can, to be honest." I sat down on a stool and took Lizzie's other hand, feeling for her pulse.
"You're not."
His feathery brows went up at that.
"You told me I was cured."
"You are," I assured him.
"If you ever had the disease in the first place."
I gave him a sharp look.
"You've never had a sore on your prick, have you? Or anywhere else?"
He shook his head, mute, a dark wave of blood staining his lean cheeks.
"Good. But the penicillin I gave you, that was some that I bought from, well, from before. That was purified, very strong and certainly potent. I'm never sure when I use this stuff," I gestured at the culturing bowls on the counter, "whether it's strong enough to work or even the right strain." I rubbed the back of my hand under my nose. The gallberry ointment had a most penetrating smell.
It doesn't always work. I had had more than one patient with an infection that didn't respond to one of my penicillin concoctions, though in those cases I'd often succeeded with another attempt. In a few instances, the person had recovered on his own before the second brew was ready. In one instance, the patient had died, despite applications of two different penicillin mixtures. Ian nodded slowly, his eyes on Lizzie's face. The first bout of chills had spent itself, and she lay quiet, the blanket barely moving over the slight round of her chest.
"If you're no sure, then, you'd not let him marry her, surely?"
"I don't know. Jamie said he'd speak to Mr. Weems, see what he thought of the matter." I rose and took the first of the slides from its pinkish bath, shook off the clinging drops, and, wiping the bottom of the slide, placed it carefully on the platform of my microscope.
"What are you looking for, Auntie?"
"Things called spirochetes. Those are the particular kind of germ that causes syphilis."
"Why?"
Despite the seriousness of the situation, I smiled, hearing the note of scepticism in his voice. I'd shown him microorganisms before, but like Jamie, like almost everyone, he simply couldn't believe that something so nearly invisible was capable of harm. The only one who had seemed to accept the notion wholeheartedly was Mulver Christie, and in her case, I thought the acceptance was due simply to her faith in me. If I told her something, she believed me. Very refreshing, after years of assorted Scots looking at me with varying degrees of squiggle-eyed suspicion.
"Has he gone home, do you think? Manfred?"
"I don't know." I spoke absently, slowly moving the slide to and fro, searching. I could make out the red blood cells, pale pink discs that floated past my field of view, drifting lazily in the watery stain. No deadly spirals visible, but that didn't mean they weren't there, only that the stain I'd used might not reveal them. Lizzie stirred and moaned, and I looked round to see her eyes flutter open.
"There, lass," Ian said softly, and smiled at her. "Better, is it?"
"Is it?" she said faintly. Still, the corners of her mouth lifted slightly, and she put a hand out from under her blanket, groping. He took it in his, patting it. "Manfred," she said, turning her head to and fro, eyes half-lidded. "Is Manfred here?"
No,
I said, exchanging a quick glance of consternation with Ian. How much had she heard?
"No, he was here, but he's gone now."
"Oh." Seeming to lose interest, she closed her eyes again. Ian looked down at her, still stroking her hand. His face showed deep sympathy, with perhaps a tinge of calculation.
"Shall I maybe carry the lassie up to her bed?"
he asked softly, as though she might be sleeping.
"And then maybe go and find..."
He tilted his head toward the open window, raising one eyebrow. "If you would please, Ian." I hesitated, and his eyes met mine, deep hazel and soft with worry, and the shadow of remembered pain. "She'll be all right," I said, trying to infuse a sense of certainty into the words.
"Aye, she will," he said firmly,
and stooped to gather her up, tucking the blanket under her.
"If I've anything to say about it..."
Chapter 46, in which things gang ugly. Manfred MacGillivray didn't come back. Ian did, with a blackened eye, skinned knuckles, and the terse report that Manfred had declared a set intention of going off and hanging himself. And good riddance to the fornicating son of a bitch, and might his rotten bowels gush forth like Judas Iscariot's, the traitorous, stinking wee turd. He then stamped upstairs to stand silent over Lizzie's bed for a time. Hearing this, I hoped that Manfred's statement was merely the counsel of temporary despair, and cursed myself for not having told him at once, and in the strongest terms, that he could be cured, whether it was absolutely true or not.
Surely he wouldn't. Lizzie was half-conscious, prostrated with the burning fevers and shaking agues of malaria, and in no fit state to be told of her betrothed's desertion, nor the cause of it. I would have to make some delicate inquiries, though, so soon as she was fit, because there was the possibility that she and Manfred had anticipated their marriage vows, and if so...
"Well, there's one thing about it," Jamie observed grimly. "The Beardsley twins were making ready to track our Porks lad down and castrate him. But now they've heard he means to hang himself, they've magnanimously decided that will do."
"Thank the Lord for small blessings," I said, sinking down at the table. "They might really do it." "The Beardsleys, particularly Josiah, were excellent trackers, and not given to idle threats."
"Oh, they would," Jamie assured me. "They were most seriously sharpening their knives when I found them at it, and told them not to trouble themselves."
I suppressed an involuntary smile at the image of the Beardsleys, bent side.